Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, revolutionaries. We just launched an incredible new podcast series at Real Vision called My Life in Four Trades. Here's a highlight for you.
My worst trades are not the trades I've lost on necessarily, because I always do it with control. The worst trades are the ones that I don't take. And that's really where the nemesis of traders comes into play, fear.
I found out just how smart I was, which is to say I went from being a very wealthy and very hubris-ridden young man to having a negative net worth on my 29th birthday. My investment goal went from surpassing the Rockefellers to just getting back to broke.
The risks I took were nuts. They were nuts. It was nuts spending 10% of my account on a trade. In some cases, 20% of my account on a trade, but typically 5 to 10% on my account on a trade. If the markets would have been different, I would have been carried out on a stretcher.
Be sure to subscribe and listen at realvision.com/mylifeinfourtrades. And be sure to use the numeral 4 when you search. Welcome to a special edition of My Life in Four Trades, recorded live with the Real Vision community in-house at our event, The Macro Experience, in San Diego, California. If you ever get a chance, I can't urge you enough to join our in-person gatherings. Our members say it's an unparalleled experience to meet our gang of experts, Raul, and fellow visionaries. We got a special treat this time recording our show with fan favorite, trader Tony Greer. Tony's financial journey was fascinating to learn more about. He's worked at some of the biggest banks in the world and now runs his own independent research firm, TG Macro, analyzing markets across the globe. Enjoy the conversation.
Hi, everyone. And Tony, welcome to My Life in Four Trades.
How are you today, Maggie?
I'm doing well, thanks. So this is a first for the podcast because it's the first one we're doing in person together in front of a live audience. So I hope that we'll have the chance for questions. I don't know. I don't have an iPad or anything up here with some. Maybe somebody will give me one. But if not, you can be sure to track down Tony afterwards and we'll get to as many as we can. But Tony, you picked four trades. The two best, the two worst, that really stand out to you in your very long career. But before we jump into that, give us a little background on you. We do the daily briefing together a lot, but we talk about markets all the time. I actually don't know that much about sort of where you came from and how you got into trading in the first place. So give us a little bit of background on Tony Greer.
Okay, I'll try to give you a really quick background. I graduated from Cornell University in 1990 with the firm intention that I wanted to work on a trading desk because my dad worked on a trading desk and he had one seat for 30 years on Wall Street, who was an over-the-counter trader for Dean Witter. So bids and offers and buying and selling were a dinner table conversation, and experience and learning about the competitiveness of the job and, you know, that it was very performance-based was something that was always intriguing with me. So to cut to the chase, I spent the first 10 years of my career out of college as a currency and commodity trader. I worked for Sumitomo Bank. I worked for 2 years for UBS. I spent some time in Zurich, and then I spent the rest of that decade up through 2000 as a commodity trader at Goldman Sachs in the J. Aron division for Goldman Sachs. And there I ran the Goldman Sachs Commodities Index for a period of time and ran the Gold Book for a period of time, which is a really powerful job. And I was down on the exchange floor for a period of time, which was really, really eye-opening. And the firm went public, and it went public at a time when I had been investing in technology stocks during the beginning of the dot-com bubble.
So you, by this point, it sounds like you had a lot of experience in a lot of different places, but it's almost going into the family business, right? I mean, this is...
Absolutely.
Because some people, you know, I grew up in a house where we didn't talk about investing. Yeah. You know, there wasn't, that just was not part of my experience, but it's something that sounds like was going on at the dinner table all the time.
Yeah, I knew what Microsoft was when I was like 8 years old, you know, so it was...
Talking in tickers.
Yeah, exactly. That was it. I mean, I remember the days that my dad got those tickers on his pad, you know, and came home and was like, I'm going to trade this Microsoft thing, you know, didn't even know what it was at the time, but that was it because he was into the trading side and the competitiveness. And
did it sound like, did it seem glamorous to you?
Oh,
did it seem exciting?
Yeah, yeah. My dad, you know, he came through the door every day, you know, loaded with energy, and then went right out to run to literally like work off all of his anxiety. But he was a great competitor at that, but he never let, he was very even keeled about managing the risk. And so I appreciated that. And I try to now carry myself the same way. But now I learned that it took him 30, 40 years to be able to do it without sweating.
Right, right. Yeah. You saw the finished product.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Were you always good at numbers too? Were you a math guy or what kind of student were you?
No, I'm a wildly average student. Wildly average. Yeah, I didn't love school. I loved where I went to school. I loved being at Cornell University, but I was, graduated with like a B+ average. And that was fine with me because it was fine with my dad, too. You know, he was all about, you know, get your experience, et cetera, et cetera. And then we'll get you out into the world. And that's what really mattered to him because he didn't go to college. So he didn't have that time in between. So
very common.
Yeah.
A lot of guys on the floor. Even when I was down there, it was, reporting from there, it was very common for people not to have gone to college, kind of go right into trading.
Well, when he realized that it was something that he could figure out and, you know, didn't necessarily need the school book smarts, he was a very street smart guy. And I think when he figured that out and got levered into seeing the success that he could have, he just figured out how to play the game.
Let's start with your first trade, and that is quoting gold to the Swiss National Bank at UBS in 1993. So sort of set the scene for us. Give us a little backdrop of what was going on in your life. How old were you?
Yeah, so I was...
Who was Tony in 1993?
Yeah, I mean, I was a 25-year-old kid that UBS, saw some potential in because I joined the FX desk with a little bit of experience and a lot of hunger. You know, I was the guy that liked to get there before everybody else and leave after everybody else. And they appreciated that about my work ethic. And so they sent me to Zurich for 6 months to work on the treasury desk there and trade currencies and commodities and really just help the risk management there. So
you're a young guy, young single guy in Europe.
Young single guy living in Zurich, having the time of my life, you know, showing up and a really cool place to trade the European time zone, by the way, because you get the... you get the end of the Asian day and then the beginning of the New York time zone. And so you get a really good look at the global picture of trading. So that was really an eye-opening experience right from there. So that we led to, let me go into just a couple of the details.
Yeah.
So to make a long story short, I get to quote the gold book. And this is very early in my career of quoting a gold price. And make a long story short, it's just a very hectic day. The market's rallying. And essentially, I was getting longer as the market went up just by the way I was managing my book, number one, trying to be long. And number two, I was getting gold sold to me, but gold was still going up. So I had a good long position. I had a winning position on the day. And we were getting towards the end of the day. And a salesman stands up and he says, you know, before the close, we got to quote Swiss National Bank for a chunk of gold. And I think it was like just a lack of gold or something like that, which is 100,000 ounces. So we get in and the salesman stands up and he's like, all right, Swiss National Bank for a lack of gold. And I'm a little bit like a deer in the headlights now because I don't have the experience yet of knowing that when you're quoting a book, you need to have small positions so you can be nimble, so you can provide liquidity and get in and out of whatever little positions you're left with. So to kind of make a long story short, I try to get the salesman's opinion on, you know, what do you think he is? And gold, they're usually sellers when the big producers call up, National Bank calls up, they're usually sellers. For some reason, one of the traders is like, this is the options guy. And I think that he's covering some negative gamma. I think he's a buyer. I think he's this way. So to make a long story short, I quoted him a bid price. If the bid offer price was sort of, call it 25 cents, bid at 75 cents on whatever handle. I quoted him like 50 cents bid at the figure. I quoted him a higher price and he sold me gold. So now I went to my position was twice as long and he asked for a fresh price. And I didn't even know that was within the realm of possibility.
So you're way over your head.
Way over my skis now and I've got a huge position on. So he says, okay, I'll sell you 100,000 ounces of gold. So now basically that made me long 200,000 ounces of gold, which is now, you know, for every dollar that it moves is $200,000 of P&L. So because I showed him a bid price, he assumed, the seller assumed that I wanted to buy. Yeah. So he looks, you know, so the salesman says, can I get a price for another 100,000? So I quoted him a dollar lower. And he said, no, I'll pass on that. And I was like, oh my God. Like, he passed on that because he's still selling. And so what he did was went around the street and hit all of the other bids in the street. And all of a sudden, my 200,000 shares was $5 out of the money. And, you know, then $10 out of the money. And now I'm just a young kid frozen deer in the headlights, and I have no idea what to do. So I start.
What's going through your head at this point,
though? I'm going to get fired.
Yeah. Like, without question.
Yeah, what's going through my head is
that you're in another country. I mean, this is a big deal,
yeah.
Right? You're like the guy, the young guy. They send you over there. I mean, you know, it doesn't get any. Were you present of mind enough to know that that was all potentially ending, or were you not even thinking about that? Like, were you?
I was concerned for my job. I thought that I was going to have a terrible P&L day, and somebody was going to drag me in a room and say, like, dude, you can't do that here. You just lost, you know, seven figures of money at 25 years old, and that's not acceptable. And so, to make a long story short, by the time the day was over, I lost more than that, and, you know, did get taken into have a conversation with, you know, the manager of the desk and everything. And he was cool about it, believe it or not. And, you know, he said that you got some bad guidance on the desk, and he recommended that. And he acknowledged that. And I think that that's probably what saved my life, because in the end, he was like, you know, you got to know that the Swiss National Bank is a seller on a rally of, you know, $7-$8 in gold, which then was a big move.
Yeah.
Because gold was like 250, bid at 350, and nobody really cared that much. So a $5-$10 move was like, you know. And so I went from having, I learned a lot of lessons that day. I went from being up on the day and having a really good day to making a mistake, being down on the day, being afraid I was going to get fired, sent home, have to look for a job, start from scratch. And luckily, you know, you learn that the people that are, that was a lesson for me where I learned that the people involved in trading are actually more understanding than you think, right? This isn't the first time that they lost $1 million on the desk in a day. And so he just wanted to have a conversation with me about it to sort of smooth out what happened. But that scarred me for a while, you know, like,
well, no doubt. How long of a period was this going on? I mean, you could see, like, if this was a movie, the close up, the sweat, the stress, the dramatic. Was it like quick in an hour, or were you in agony for like half the day trying to get yourself out of this hole?
Yeah, it was probably four to five hours of, you know, from the time that I went from having an up day to quoting them a bid price to getting sold that gold to the time I got out of the gold and knew my P&L, it was like 4 hours before, you know. And now I'm like twisting. You know, I didn't have a lot of allies there. Everybody in the office spoke Swiss German, and they're like, you know, look at Superman over here that just lost seven figures in a day.
So. Well, I was going to ask, at any point did you think about asking for help?
Oh, yeah, I was asking for help with getting liquidity, you know, and that's how it goes on the desk. And you're like, when you make a decision that you have to get out of something, you're like, all right, get me gold prices. Right. And everybody in the room will go to your liquidity. Everybody in that case has got a scheduled call that they've got to make to go out, and they'll call and find somebody to bid them for gold, whoever their counterparty is to call. And then, you know, I would say I got to sell this 300,000 ounces now. And literally by the time I got done selling it, it was the low tick of the day. And then it traded up $3 or $4 after that. And I like sat at my desk like this for about, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes after the close and just contemplated what was going to happen. And that was a brutal time.
Right, and then there. You get the phone call. Can you come see me?
Yeah. Yeah. And I literally thought it was like, you know, I'm going home.
Yeah.
You know, but
marching the gangplank.
Yeah, exactly. But it worked out okay. So, you know, you learn that that's kind of in the course of business at some level. And I just had to do better the next time. But that was really agonizing.
I'm curious, like, how did you manage to come in the next day? Because, like, it's one thing when you survive, but then you have that weird feeling, like you walk in and it feels like everyone's staring at you, and you know.
Well, that part was okay. I'm a kind of terminal optimist, and so I've never woken up one morning thinking that today was not going to be better than yesterday.
And even so, that day.
Yeah, even that day. I had already gone through hell, right? It was like, you know, when once I got the confirmation that I was not getting fired, like my blood pressure calmed down, my hands stopped sweating, you know, and I could finally gain some composure and just kind of think about it, but.
Did you understand in that moment that it was a mistake from inexperience, or did you sort of doubt that you had what it took? Because up until now, you're impressing everyone.
Yeah, it had been going fairly well. And this was just, you know, this was one event. And what I decided was that I shouldn't lean on anybody, right? If you're the gold dealer and you're responsible for quoting the gold book and reporting a P&L at the end of every day, I don't really care what that sales trader says anymore.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, I had a conversation with him, and he was abundantly apologetic. and, you know, the whole thing. And he's like, I didn't know your position at the time and all this stuff. And so there was some stuff that we got through and a lot of learning experience. But it was one of the mega lessons in my life about being at a broker dealer and what goes on when things go completely wrong.
Yeah. Did it change the way you approached risk?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, then it became understanding. Then it was the beginning of my understanding that, you know, as running the gold book, it's, you know, this is a lesson of working at a big bank. You know, running that book, it's not your job to be, you know, first of all, as an inexperienced trader, it's definitely not your job to have maximum risk on all the time and really be wheeling positions around. The job there in that seat is to provide liquidity for people that want to trade gold, for clients of the bank, for internal traders of the bank, proprietary traders, traders on the desk that have all got a gold position. Anybody that's got that on is going right through you. So, you know, you kind of learned after that even though I'm bullish, sometimes it makes sense to be just flat when the market's going up so that I can quote somebody and have the freedom to be like, okay, I don't know which way he is. I'm just going to bid an offer and buy or sell and then lay off the risk. And if you do that all the time, you know, there's value in the book that you can glean because a lot of times you've got better liquidity than you just offered your client. So there's ways to, you know, to get a lot savvier about becoming a desk dealer. And from there, I made it my life's vocation to learn how to be a good desk dealer and to quote markets better.
You understood the job better than
yeah.
you first walked
yeah,
in the
exactly.
door.
Yeah, exactly. It was a much fuller understanding of your role in that yeah. seat. And it wasn't, I thought it was, you know, they're sending me across the pond to Zurich. I got to make money. You know, I'm going to go there and I'm going to be the, you know, smart guy from New York and I'm going to try to outtrade and outwork everybody. And, you know, you eventually go speeding into a wall at some point.
Yeah. But you got back up. You didn't take it to heart. You didn't think, wow, I thought I was a really great trader and I suck at trading.
Yeah, no, it was every day. Every day has always been a new day for me, both in life and in trading. And I think that's important. And, you know, when you take your lumps, it's okay. When you go to sleep that night, it's over. It's got to be over.
And you felt like that as a young, it's easier when you're young, I think, to feel like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, because I didn't have any responsibility except myself. Yeah. So that changes for some of the other trades.
And you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
So your second trade is buying short-dated S&P puts during the great financial crisis of 2008. So once again, so this is a long time. You've been at it a long time now. You have a lot more experience now. So where are you? What are you doing? Have you shifted the kind of work you're doing?
So in life now, I had just left Bank Hapalim, where I ran an equity desk and a sales and trading operation there. And I had really tight restrictions on trading. In fact, they made it for me so that I essentially could not trade. And, you know, while I was irritated with that, I understood the role that I had there because I just had this old lesson several years back. So I'm like, okay, I can facilitate this job. It's worth it. And then I had left there. I went to Dahlman Rose, which was a really maverick natural resources based sales and trading shop broker dealer to work for my friend Ernie Dahlman and to work on a desk where, you know, I really thought that I could do even better than I was doing at Bank Hapalim. I had a ton of equity business that I was putting through the machines. I was making a good living, et cetera, et cetera. And the great financial crisis happened, right? So the market's now 2008, the market's crashing.
But I think it's worth pausing for, so I know most people were, you know what happened then and were in that, but I mean, it was a really crazy time. I mean, people were petrified. Things were going on. People didn't want to talk about things. I mean, there were really, really experienced traders and investors who were just scared. The wheels were coming off, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you could sense a lot of that too. You could sense that in the market. And that's what helped me with my trade in that I wanted to speculate that the market was going down, right? So I, you know, here I am sitting at leaving having a big job at Bank Hapalim where I'm a manager to going to Dahlman Rose where I'm like a co-manager, but really I run a team of sales traders, five sales traders, and that's my job. But now I can trade again, right? I've got very loose restrictions on what I can do. So to make a long story short, when, you know, I've got a trading group of friends and my confidants are like, yeah, this tape is going to go down. You know, we start hearing about when you're at a shop like that, you start hearing about, hey, I can't take this guy's name. Once you hear that, you're like, wait a minute, there's credit issues.
What do you mean? So you can't take this guy's name as a counterparty?
This was before things cratered then.
Well, it was during. It was during. Okay. It was during things cratering, because that's when, you know, that's eventually when, you know, what became the big story was that Lehman's credit is no good.
Yeah.
Like, excuse me, how is that possible?
So this was the stuff people didn't want to talk about. When I would talk to them as a reporter, I would ask them questions and they just wouldn't, you could tell what they weren't saying. And it was things like this.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want to call anybody out or create more panic.
Yeah.
But it was things like,
yeah, it's just the bank makes a decision and says, okay, we're reading about this in the paper. It looks like their credit is bad. Send a memo down to the desk that you can't trade with them.
What did you think when you were getting that?
Well, you know that it's some kind of inherent systemic risk that they're addressing, right? So what it does is it made me even more bearish. So I figured out a strategy where I was buying short-dated puts on the S&P. So to make a long story short, to sort of lay that out, when markets were having retracement rallies, I was still mega bearish, and I would kind of sit around I'd pick a strike either a week or 2 weeks out, and I would sit around in these out-of-the-money puts and just bid absurdly cheap prices for them, like, you know, nickel and dime prices, and I would stick those bids in, and I would see what kind of contracts I could accumulate because I wanted to own these puts for when the market turned. And when the market turned, I knew that volatility would expand, direction would go down, and my puts would explode. So to make a long story short.
But not everyone was, it seems in hindsight, the great financial crisis, everybody's like, oh, the world was falling apart. Of course that was, but not everyone was in agreement and people didn't believe these worst case scenarios were going to happen.
No.
There was a, you know, it wasn't so obvious.
No, it was a contrarian trade, really, which was what gave me confidence, you know, and it's like one of those things that you're like a wise guy sales trader almost, and you're like, oh yeah, this tape is going down, you know, and you look at it technically and you've got 8 ways through Sunday that you're bearish about it. And so to get to the trade point is that I was buying these options and collecting for as much as I could for a nickel, for a dime. And then they were expiring in those 2 weeks, the tape would peter out on the upside and turn and crater. And a lot of times close on the lows, the days that the options were expiring. So I would just let them roll off at the price. And some of them were expiring at $1.50, $2, $5. So I'm making absurd returns on my money. And so I'll tell you the story that when I left Happelim and I went to Dahlman Rose, I opened up an account specifically for trading, like for being aggressive. My wife was all on board and I threw $50,000 in just to say like, okay, let's go, let's get going here. And so my wife asked me after a couple of months and she's like, you know, how are we doing with the account? And I was like, pretty good. And she's like, really? I'm like, yeah. She's like, did you get it through, like, is it 6 figures yet? And I was like, oh, it's a couple of them. And she's like, what? So to make the story, this is the wild part. The day that I was like, all right, here, let's go into my account and I'll show you where we are now. So she comes down and I call up the account and she's like, there's $475,000 in this account. And I'm like, yeah, what do you think? She's like, that's unbelievable. She's like, keep going. Right? So I'm like,
This is the advisor at home.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So to make a long story short.
Were there other conversations immediately about where that money was going?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's the best trade. That's on the best trade list of my life, right? And now we're going to end that and we're going to talk about
it. I want to ask you a question, though.
It's the same trade.
I know.
Yeah.
I got a sneak peek at them. But I want to ask you about having the confidence what gave you the confidence to be contrarian, especially, so it's one thing when you're contrarian and you want to stick to your guns, but in the chaos of what was happening in 2008, like what made you so sure that that was the right thing to do?
You know,
because people were literally afraid to do anything. Like people who had the right idea, when you think the wheels are coming off and you're seeing what a lot of us weren't, right? And we found out about this afterwards, but people were like, this is, I'm like scared about what's happening. People were like close to run on banks. Like you remember how scary that was. People were not making decisions. What made you be so sure that that was
Because the market continued to, number one, confirm my belief due to the way it was behaving technically. So with a bearish view, you would sit there and say, okay, we've bottomed now. There's a couple of comments on the tape that are going to make this short cover. You know, let's see where the resistance level is. Like where's a really, really high level for this to peter out. And so as, you know, if it got close to there on the approach, you're like, okay, well, I think it's going to totally fail here. So what I would do is I kind of scan the market and look at where my sort of the internals of the market were still breaking down. For example, even though the S&P was rallying, you know, big stocks were still flat on the week, or they were, big stocks were up on the week, and on Friday's close, they would close dead even, you know, flat on the week. And, you know, those were my, one of my signals. And then another signal that is no longer a signal is something called LIBOR OIS, which is basically an interbank interest rate that banks charge each other to lend each other money. And before the Fed came in and really distorted that, you could see that this LIBOR IOS rate would be ticking higher and higher and higher. And you'd be like, yeah, these banks are, there's more stress. There's more credit stress. There's, you know, this trade is not over yet. And I'm going to keep doing this until I see a reason or a total capitulation on the downside.
Do you think being a trader made you more aware than maybe some fundamental, you know, people, maybe business people who are looking at a thing? Do you think the fact that you were so in tune based on all the jobs you had of those kind of indicators gave you a sort of line of sight?
Yeah, it was helpful because I'm noticing now, you know, there's people that are only stock centric, right? And in the stock market, especially, you realize that when you deal in equities, there are people that really only care about equities, right? And they're really like bottom up researchers, you know, like they start by knowing, you know, the CEO and what his plans are, et cetera, et cetera. So they're bottom up stock pickers. And, you know, a lot of those people never really gave up the ghost. You know, they were like, you know, reiterating buys on the way down for starters. And kind of when you have the opposite idea and the market's confirming your idea and you're seeing people like, you know, stick to their guns on positions that are already wrong.
Yeah.
You look at that and you're like.
And they were not insignificant people, too.
No, these were some,
you know, these were some people who had a reputation who, you know.
Yeah, but the tape continued to confirm, you know, that was the thing. And that was when I sort of developed a much more serious study that now converted into the sort of process behind TG Macro and how I get into trades now and my analysis process, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So that was the very beginning of it, of getting a lot more serious about it.
Well, when you have a win like that.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't even think that something like that was possible or that I would ever be able to pull it off. And when I did, it was really, really refreshing. But, you know, I'll have to say that the story ends right where my wife and I sat and looked at the account. And that was the sentiment moment that we had to check it out and just see exactly where it was. And that was the high print.
Did you know it at the time?
Nope. I thought I was going to make another $5 million and buy myself a couple of cars and a pool. And so I didn't, you know, I knew
they were spending that money.
Yeah,
I knew it.
Yeah. That's how I was thinking about it.
So this is the first time that one of someone's best trade ever is also their next trade. Your third trade is your second. It's another worst trade or another one of your losers. And it's the same exact trade.
Yeah, this is the worst trade of my life. This was a really, really rough experience for me. So I turned that $50,000 that I turned into $450,000 over a course of about 8 or 9 months. To cut to the chase, I turned it back into $50,000 in the next year and a half. So it was probably just trying to use the same strategy after things changed. And I was upsizing my bets on the way down instead of bidding for $5,000 or $10,000 worth of long dated calls and just having those lottery tickets. I was actively buying, like paying offers and going home on a weekend with $150,000 worth of puts and just having an enormous position and saying, okay, if these expire worthless, come and get me. And they came and got me. You know, and it was
this is just a continuation.
Yeah,
right?
So what happened?
It's the same year.
Yeah, exactly. The market bottomed. And that was literally when my wife and I did the, okay, let's take a look at the account. And it was very much like, you know, this thing is done to me. Like the S&P, the sentiment at that time at the bottom of the financial crisis, somebody said to me, one of my friends that's a fund manager on the phone when I asked him with the S&P on like an 800 handle, I was like, you know, he's the sole manager of the fund. I'm like, what do you think here, dude? He goes, dude, it's going to get so that like admitting that you have a stock at a cocktail party is going to be like admitting you have syphilis. And I was like, oh my God, like really, this is like, you know, this is the end. Like this is the end of the stock market. This is the end of stock investing because that's what it felt like.
And it did.
That was one, you know, Lehman was going bankrupt.
Anybody here working, trading at that time? Yeah, I saw some people nodding their heads. It was horrible. It felt like that's so funny to hear that now in retrospect, but it's seriously like that crazier things were said.
Yeah, and then even, you know, I was so pigheaded about it. So the part that was so horrible was that, you know, you would see, you know, the, right, the Fed turns on QE, you know, and I'm like, what the hell is that going to do? You know, like this doesn't matter at all, because I didn't understand the mechanism by how that was going to work. I was like, so what?
Well,
so
they're going to. No one did.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, so they're going to buy all these securities and they're going to what? Disappear? Right? Like they're going to get wiped off the face of the earth. And even David Tepper came out on TV and made what everybody knows is probably the greatest call in the history of trading, when he was like, you know, that was it. The Fed is going to make sure that they arrange us, you know, they rearrange this market. They're going to pump liquidity. And, you know, he was insanely bullish at the bottom, and Appaloosa had that great year. And I was like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. This guy's crazy, you know? And I, literally that was my mentality. But because I confused a good trade for having brains, for being smart, right? And I thought that since I had a 10-bagger trade, it's like this guy's getting on TV to pump the market up so he can sell his stock. This is the biggest bunch of bullshit. You know, I was so cynical. And it was just like, at that point, I was Zeus as a trader in my mind. And when I got to the point of buying $25,000 worth of options and then buying $100,000 worth of options, and I've had even bigger positions than that, and have almost all of it expire worthless, that's when that's when you have a come to Jesus moment. And when the account got back down to a $40,000 handle, I closed it, because I was like, I'm not gonna blow this 40 grand now. I was like, this is the worst, you know, goddamn experience of my life. And I hadn't told my wife yet.
Oh.
Yeah, so that was.
How'd that go?
Poorly, poorly. You know, it went poorly, because she was counting on, you know, that being there and me not giving that back, right? So when it was, that money was gone, it was like, what? How did you do that? And I made a mistake. The period that I gave it back was I had the wrong time frame. I made the money in about 4 months and gave it back in about 8. And now that I think about it, that was the exact time frame. So it was taking those chances, trying to live through, you know, not talking about it. And it wasn't like I was hiding it from my wife, but we just weren't talking about it. And
you,
I was like,
was
all right,
turn around.
Yeah, I'm going to make, like, one of these, I'm going to buy $100,000 worth of puts, and that's going to be a $1 million trade. And this is going to be $1.3 million.
Do you regret not saying anything? Cause she may have questioned you.
Yeah, I probably do. She's, you know, she's often,
she
she's
is
a
still
Wall
your wife,
Streeter.
Right?
She's a Wall Streeter too. She's a Goldman Sachs alumni and super sharp, and has always had good intuition in trading, believe it or not. And it's really, really, you know, because she's not in the trading game, but has had given me good advice as an outsider watching me trade. And so it definitely would have been a better idea to bring her into that, because then I would have taken a partner in the turmoil, and maybe she would have said something like, you know what, how about make believe you turn 50 into 250 and let's stop now.
Yeah.
Right. That would have been brilliant, because that would have been something that she might have said. And so it was, because it was all on me, and because I had done it myself, I was like, I got myself into this mess, and I'm going to get myself out. And it was the market gods that were like,
how stressed out were you at that time?
It took such a toll on my life that one of the things that I learned was that I mixed in my life with the trade. So that's a relevant part. Right. So I told you that I had a job as a head of an equity desk at Bank Hapoalim, at a big Israeli bank. And I forewent that opportunity because there were a lot of issues there to contend with. But I saw a great opportunity at Dahlman Rose. And then when I sat down, because of what was going on, commissions were raining from the sky. Right. So my commission business was flourishing. And that's why I was like, oh, it's OK. You know, like if I lose a little back, it's okay, because I just had a good month. And that is the stupidest thing that I've ever thought in my life. It's like, what does your job have to do with this trade? It has nothing, right? But I was saying, thinking to myself, it's like, well, if I have a great month and I'm plus, you know, XYZ $1,000 here, if I lose XYZ $1,000 here, it's like pays for itself.
Yeah.
You know, and then you realize that, you know, nothing matters except the P&L. And at the P&L, you know, it's funny to listen when he says, that everybody here is like money hungry or things like that. And it's like, I wouldn't call myself money hungry, but I care about the scoreboard more than anything.
Yeah, the competition.
Yeah, well, it's the score. It's winning. It's like, you know, I've racked up more points than anybody else, and that's kind of the competitive level, and that's also the level of kind of hubris that winds up taking you down a few notches once you get it wrong.
What's interesting is you knew what it was like to take outside risks, right? You had that lesson at the very beginning of your career.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that it happened again? Like, did you forget about that lesson, or?
I just thought, you know, I mistook it as a different opportunity. I mistook it as a different, you know, this is something different, right? This is Lehman going bankrupt. This is a black swan from outer space. Like, nobody's ever seen this. So that kind of gave me the balls or whatever to keep trying and not quit at this trade. And it got the best of me. And so after I closed after that 12-month experience, I didn't trade for 4 years. Not one trade.
Really?
Not $1 of risk in the markets.
You'd always trade it, though.
Always, always. And I had to stop because that was just torture to me. It was while my business was going well, I was acting like a jerk because I was so angry at how this trade was going. So I was like beside myself, and it was taking me out of that game. So now I went to Dolman Rose and I brought over 5 traders with me and I ran this pod and, you know, here I am snapping at everybody like, dude, come on, you know, like, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like,
did they ever call you out on it? Like, did anyone know what was going on?
My partner did. My partner that was there, kind of my another sales trader that was there with me, knew the whole story and didn't have anything to say about it. He was just like,
shaking his
head. It's all you, man. You know, not something that he would have done, but
yeah,
it's all right.
Did you, when you made the mistake, not mistake, but when you had your first bad trade, you shook it off because you're an optimist. You woke up every day. It doesn't sound like that happened this time.
Yeah, no, that wasn't. You know, what I shook off was the money being gone. You know, I shook that off. That was quick. That was like, all right, dude, you can come to the realization of that. That you can forget you even had it. Right. Like, just forget that it was even there. I mean, it was, you know, it was something. The reason that it was cool.
That's a lot of money to forget.
Yeah, well, it was a lot because I was about to make it bigger. You know, that was the idea, was that it was going to be like really a big chunk of the nest egg. And we were going to go after this trade and, you know, be done investing when we were done with this trade. You know, and that's another thing that you learn is that now I don't ever look at anything as a this is it trade. You know, now it's like, OK, where does this fit within the way I've liked all these other trades in my life? And okay, control yourself, because in 5 years, there's going to be another trade. And 5 years from that, there's going to be another one. And so I try to keep that in mind and kind of manage everything within its own silo. And I feel like that's something that I learned from that, and to keep things, you know, because I was making the huge mistake of confusing my commission dollars with, you know, being okay for losing money over here or paying for, you know, Robin Peter to pay for Paul. That kind of thing, and that never works out. So
did you at this point though doubt your skill? Why did you hang up the trading? Did you just feel like
there was
stress on your life, or did you think that you just you weren't good at it?
Well, put it this way, I tried to turn a negative into a positive, and I looked at my commission business that was still ringing off the hook, and you know, I was like, all right, I have to focus as the guy that wants to shrug this off, become an optimist and be positive again. I was like, all right, let me focus on this team around me and the situation that we have. Right, we've got a once in a lifetime situation to be brokers through, and we're doing a ton of business. And so let me just go about, you know, earning every one of these dollars back the hard way instead of the easy way, you know. And so that was big.
So let's go to your fourth trade. And I want to circle back on something you said with that, but let's go to your fourth trade. And that is, now you're back in, somehow you find your way back into trading. So before we talk about the trade itself, what was it that triggered you after those 4 years to get back into it? You start your own firm.
Yeah, you know, I left, I guess when Cowen bought Dolman Rose, that was probably 4 years later. And when I left there to start what I call the pickup basketball season of my career, that I was totally miserable working for 3 different shops in 3 years. And that's not the kind of guy that I am, or that's not the way to conduct a trading business kind of thing. It was a matter of circumstances. And so I decided then that I was like, all right, you know, I'm not that happy with this that's going on, but you know what, if I start trading again, at least I'll be able to focus on that and tune out a lot of the noise that's at these 3 shops that I went to, that I, didn't have a lot of allies or a lot of friends, and I was just kind of figuring out how to get my feet back under me after, you know, Cowen bought Dolman and my great commission deal evaporated because they weren't going to pay me the same thing that Dolman Rose was. All the sales traders that I went with went in a different direction.
The industry changed. This happened.
Yeah, it was like the rug got pulled off from everybody, and everybody scattered and went to different places for quite a while.
Right. So how did you feel when you started trading again? Like, were you kind of enthusiastic? Like, it feels good. It feels like where I belong. Or you're kind of like, I don't know how I, you know.
No, it was refreshing. I was thrilled to get, I feel like I got a part of myself back.
So the scars healed.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you get a little bit of your mojo back. You know, it's all about, you know, feeling like a master of the universe within your own trade. Mm-hmm. And I guess when you get that life mojo back from having it be absent for so many years, I guess that it builds into your personal confidence, and that affects other things that you do in your business. And so I was very careful about to not have that thing go wrong again, right? And so what I did was, when I restarted it, I wrote out a set of ground rules for this account so that I wouldn't have the same disaster scenario. And I started with no options, right? Like, no more of that stuff, you know, like just too toxic, too tempting. And, you know, decided that I wanted to just set up a trading account that was going to be like, where I was gonna buy things for cash, sell them higher, you know, try not to even short things. I just wanted to be, you know, I wanted to keep it as simple as I could. And that's how I kind of evolved into this trading strategy that I have now, where I don't do anything fancy. I hunt trades that start in the bottom left corner of my screen and go to the top right corner of my screen. And I figure out where I can jump in the middle.
Which you have told us when we get some great questions and you're like, listen, So your fourth trade, and this is a winner.
Yeah.
We're happy to say, is buying oil lockdown lows in the spring of 2020.
Yeah, that was exciting because that was the energy market that we're in now is a bull market that I've been waiting for, because I've been waiting to really crush a bull market properly. You know, like with the dot-com market, I had invested in it and done well with it, and things went well, but there was a huge drawdown, you know, after that. So from the level that I had taken my account to, a huge drawdown to where it was, but it wasn't anything traumatic. This was just sort of getting back on my feet and trading again. But I was waiting for I had been sitting around saying, okay, the next bull market in commodities or equities is mine, right? Like I've got to really be able to dig in. And then we get the situation with COVID, the pandemic, the lockdown, crude oil going to zero. And as a commodity trader, you know that this is just not sustainable, right? The world runs on commodities. We are in a completely artificial lockdown situation. This is a one of a kind scenario. And so I started poking around at some of my friends at Morgan Stanley and at Goldman Sachs that work on energy desks. And when oil was, you know, literally $10 a barrel on its way to a negative print, I was calling these guys up and saying, let me ask you this. Are you guys quoting your clients like their lifetime supply of gasoline right now? Because I would love to buy my lifetime supply of gasoline right now, right at this price, right here, right? Like oil's $10 a barrel, unleaded gas is like 48 cents or whatever it was. I was like, let's just buy all the gas that we ever need. And they're like, are you crazy? Like, dude, are you out of your mind? I was like, are you out of your mind? Like, what are we gonna run things on going forward? Are we gonna use no more gas going forward? So you noticed about all of the stimulus that I got on the way down was so revealing about how this trade, how commodities were not gonna last at this price. So one of my friends called me up and was like, so hold on a second. So if I have like a 40 gallon tank and the price is negative $2, I'm gonna go fill my tank up and the guy's gonna give me $80? Is that how that's gonna work? I was like, no, it's never gonna work like that. And that was one of the things, like, this is how people are thinking now. And that's kind of why I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm trying to buy my lifetime supply of gasoline here, and this guy that doesn't know commodity markets thinks he's going to get cash back when he fills up his truck. You know, there's a grave misunderstanding with what's going on.
I see a dislocation.
Yeah,
I
there's
need
a
to
dislocation
take
in what's going on, and so that was a situation where it was okay. Let's buy oil futures at teens, single digits, and figure out what to do from here. And to make a long story short, it was really difficult to hold on to. And to cut to the chase, I probably let half of it out in the 70s or 80s just to say, wow, that was like my old spy trade, like a really, really successful life-changing trade. And because of my new method that I developed along the way of having a trailing stop on the balance of my position, I was kind of sitting around with oil in the 80s and 90s saying, all right, this trade's getting old. I'm about done here. Like, I'm ready to sell my futures. And then Putin invaded Ukraine and handed me a bid. And I was like, okay, we're out. That's it. That trade's over and we're done. So now it's a question of managing that P&L back into risk and figuring out how to run this trade for the next 10 years, because I think that's how long it's going to be with us. And so that's another thing that I managed to develop back then, was saying, okay, nothing is an all-in trade anymore.
Yeah.
Everything is a let's see how this goes. And that's sort of, I guess that's a way to show how it sort of evened out my, I figured out how to smooth out my mentality with that kind of approach, if that's fair.
Yeah.
And so all of it was really, really unbelievable learning experience.
So what would your advice be to somebody who's trading now? And I think it's really telling that you said that when you were going through that really hard period, you were alone.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, the nature of it now is they're trading from home and they're alone. So what is your advice from these trades that you've learned that you might want to pass on?
Well, I mean, we could speak to that a little bit and say that a lot of the things that I learned both right and wrong about the trades while I was in them and after them all came from talking to people. So like you said, like, you know, there's no reason to be alone in trading. There's no reason to have a, you know, one of the things that you learn at Goldman when, you know, you get into heavy duty, risky situations that spring up out of the blue on a trading desk is take a partner, right? Grab somebody else and say, how should we look at this? Because now there's no longer that risk of let's put this trade in the drawer. Right. Let's just, you know, hide this and not let it, you know, as outrageous as that always was to me, I'd never had the, you know, the stones to do something as crazy as that. But the smoothing out of the decision making process and being a little bit more calm about it, I guess, is what I picked up. If I was going to say, if I was going to give some advice, I think that it has to do with, number one, let my lessons save you money, you know, and take me up on the advice. Believe me, if you're a beginner trader or an intermediate, anything short of an expert, don't trade options, you know, don't lever yourself, you know, I have such tight parameters on my risk now, on my position sizes, everything is really scientific. I never risk more than 1% of my capital on any trade. And I've got a real method. And I've gone from saying, okay, I'm going to read the newspapers, the books, and everything that I can about the world, and I'm going to decide what I think about it. I'm going to put on my positions, and I'm going to wait for the world to conform to what I thought. Whereas now, it's looking at the market with open eyes every day, every week, every month, every quarter, and every year on the closes, and studying all of that information intently across indexes, sectors, macro securities, across everything. And having done that study now very seriously since I started TG Macro, my trading performance has exploded. And so that was a real learning experience of going through the highs and the lows and getting beat up and black eyes and inner turmoil and, you know.
That's fantastic. Tony, thank you so much. This was so great. And I love that when we do these podcasts, I'm finding that the worst trades are the ones that people learn the most from.
Exactly.
and talk about the most and are as important as the winning ones.
Yeah,
so thank you so much for sharing.
Sure. You shrug off the pain and, you know, you remember the lesson that you take from it. So thank you for
sharing it.
Bringing all that out. Yeah, absolutely. I hope that helped some people.
It did. Great.
All right. That's a wrap on this week's edition of My Life in Four Trades. For more on the series, visit realvision.com/my-life-in-4-trades. Make sure to use the numeral 4. This podcast is a production of Real Vision. Our executive producer is Lisa Desai. Our producers are Frank Fowler and Michelle Ribeiro. Our sound engineer is Levi Mercurio. Our production assistant is Ranjani Venkatakrishnan. And this show is hosted by me, Maggie Lake.